Blog Talk Radio.
Gather together and talk about the beautiful game. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It is time for the Two Guys Soccer Show. As always, I am Mike. I am joined by my partner in crime, my affiliate in all things extra, Stead. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, brother. It's great to be on with you again.
Yeah, I know we took a week off for to do our civic duty and vote, but we are back once again and ready to talk the beautiful game. And we are back. We are gooder. We are uglier. And we are badder. And we are, as always, brought to you by the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Montgomery County, Maryland's best venue for sports and live music. So, it's been a while, my man.
Yeah, it's been a while. It's been a while. A lot has happened in the past couple of weeks in the football world.
I know, man. I felt lonely last week, but I feel better now. All is right with the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We're back in the chair. The dials are running well. Let's get to it. So, weekend, my friend, what do you think? What was your good thing that happened? What did you enjoy watching?
Well, in my innate inability to peel my eyes from the television when the Premier League is on, I was able to see in my computer screens and in my news feeds and on my Twitter feed that Barcelona took an L this weekend.
Barcelona did take an L, their first loss at home in years.
Yes. And they lost to Real Betis, who's had a pretty good run this year. They're doing okay. They're mid-table, but they got four wins. And even though they're mid-table, they're still only 8 points off the top of the table. But in seeing that, I went and did a little bit of digging around just to see what's currently going on in La Liga. And this was quite a chippy weekend in La Liga. You had six red cards, some really, really action-packed soccer. I was able to kind of tune in and check out as many highlights as I could from the great highlight innovator known as YouTube. And in noticing that, I was looking at the table, and there is a real competition going on in La Liga. From really, you know, you could look at from about 15 up, there is a 10-point gap in points from Valencia in 15th place to Barcelona in first place after 12 matches, which is more than 25% of the season. And normally by this time in leagues outside of the Premier League, you have basically the two or three teams that are going to run away with it. And then usually by January or February, you pretty much know who the toss-up is. And that's not to say that that's going to change in La Liga, but for what's going on right now, you're not seeing one team with already a 20 to 30 or 40 goal differential. You're seeing really, really competitive play in a league that I really haven't been too high on because I felt there was a lack of competition, which is probably my own fault because those teams do tend to play very well in Europe. But for what we were talking about with the Premier League and with the way those teams are beating up on each other week in and week out, looks like it's happening in Spain. And I'm curious to see how this is going to affect a lot of their Champions League and Europa League performances. But this is my good. My good is really that competitive balance going on in Spain. And you have now Real Madrid, who's crept back into sixth place now. But you have a four-point differential from sixth place to first place. They're going to be fighting for these Champions League and Europa League spots. This is going to be an exciting year in La Liga, and to the point where I think I'm going to have to go ahead and bite the bullet, switch over my carrier so I can get BN Sports, so so I can pay a bit more, a bit closer attention to this.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And what is nice to see is at that quarter pole that you speak of, we have some less familiar names at or near the Champions League places in La Liga.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at Sevilla in second place,
mm-hmm.
Behind Barcelona.
Mm-hmm.
Alaves, one of the smaller teams,
mm-hmm.
all the way up there, tied with Atletico Madrid
mm-hmm.
And Sevilla
mm-hmm.
on 23 points. The other team in Catalonia, Espanyol.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, Barcelona's like, you know, redheaded stepchild who they seem to just kick around whenever they feel like it. It's hanging around.
And all the way down, Real Sociedad hanging
mm-hmm.
in there, only 4 points back
mm-hmm.
of Real Madrid and 8 points
mm-hmm.
off. Getafe,
mm-hmm.
one of my favorite clubs, only because in order to get more fans once, they produced an adult movie.
Oh, you gotta love that, man.
That was that they figured they were so small, they couldn't attract new fans. The only way that they could get more fans was to breed them. So they put out an adult movie to facilitate that. Only in soccer does something like that happen.
Of course.
So, yeah, the competitive balance in La Liga this year, it is nice to see
mm-hmm.
Barcelona and Real Madrid not running away with this.
Mm-hmm.
To see these other teams, at least at this point, sticking and staying. You know, Sevilla has always been a solid team.
Mm-hmm.
At year, Europe in the Champions League, but to see
mm-hmm.
them up near the top and challenging. We know the story with Atletico Madrid
mm-hmm.
and Diego Simeone.
Mm-hmm.
El Alaves, a much smaller team. They only were promoted a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they've avoided relegation. And almost you want to look at them sort of in the mold of a Bournemouth.
Just yeah. That's exactly what I was thinking.
And keeps up despite financial limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Just looking up and down, Girona in ninth place.
Mm-hmm.
Levante, which is a team that you don't normally see unless they're getting beat by Real Madrid or
mm-hmm.
Barcelona, one that has given them trouble in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Real Sociedad from the Basque Country, another one of those teams. All good teams that are interesting to pay attention to. And I may have to enjoy more of Ray Hudson's commentary
mm-hmm.
and watch some more La Liga as this season moves forward, because it, if nothing else, it looks like it is going to be competitive
mm-hmm.
throughout the remainder of the season between those teams. Now,
mm-hmm.
you did mention Real Madrid, who made the announcement this year that they were going to sign Santiago Solari to a 2.5-year deal through 2021 as their permanent manager. He has overseen, if you will, a renaissance.
Absolutely.
Four wins on the trot, 15 scored, 2 conceded. The
mm-hmm.
best start for a new manager since 1929.
Wow.
Yeah, but then you look at the competition.
Right.
4-0 over Mejia in the Copa del Rey.
Mm-hmm.
Mejia, a town of 32,000. The whole entire city located in Morocco is actually smaller than the Bernabeu.
Yeah, I think you could fit 3 of them in the Bernabeu, and they'll be fine.
2-0 over Valladolid. Not a bad win. I mean, Valladolid sitting Real Madrid in 7th place on 17 points. A 5-0 win in the Champions League over Victoria Pilsen, one that we thought they would get.
Yeah.
And then a 4-2 victory against Celta de Vigo.
Mm-hmm.
This was good enough to get him the full-time job. It is going to be very interesting to see how this continues.
Right.
Apparently, players all gave him a vote of confidence. They enjoyed the work. The club, Florentino Perez, liked the work that he did at Real Madrid Castilla, even though for a lot of his time there, they were actually in the relegation zone. But they thought he was a solid coach.
Mm.
is he another case of them somehow unearthing another Zinedine Zidane type character from within, or is this a case of just Real Madrid has such overwhelming talent and they were willing to play for him and somebody came in with new ideas and was able to get on a good run and you got that new manager bounce, and as the matches go forward after the international break, the wheels will start to fall off again. But we now go in because of Spanish labor law, they had to make a decision on him by this weekend.
Right.
Because he only remained the interim manager for 2 weeks. So Biden had to make a decision. Apparently the decision that they made is that they are going to stick with him. I am a bit surprised by contract. I thought you would get him to the end of the season and then they evaluate or possibly give him this season and all next. The 2.5-year commitment is a pretty solid commitment and a solid indication that Antonio Conte is not going to be offering for them anytime soon.
No.
Mr. Jose Mourinho.
Yeah, or Mauricio Pochettino.
Yes. Now, it is worth noting that that contract comes up right around the time that we could be looking at Mauricio Pochettino.
Exactly. Yeah.
Out his contract at Spurs.
Yeah, I'm thinking too that I was very pleased that they went ahead and gave him the vote of confidence. I totally agree with you. I think they did their due diligence to try and lure another big name coach or even bring back someone who they knows, you know, kind of like a, no, I hate to make this comparison, but like to a Big Sam, but someone who you know is going to right the ship and at least make sure they remain competitive and finish in a spot that Real Madrid is relatively accustomed to. But it was nice to see them giving a vote of confidence to a 40, 41, 42-year-old manager who really hasn't had experience at the top managerial, top professional levels. So I was also shocked by the length of the contract. I was assuming it was going to be just till the remainder of this, just till the rest of the year, and just kind of say, look, don't worry about it. We're going to take care of you this year. You're going to stay in the fold. So let's just finish out the season strong. We love what you're doing. Set him up to probably take over again down the line in a relatively similar fashion to the way Manchester United did with Ryan Giggs. But the 2.5 years is shocking, but it made me smile a little bit. I was happy for him.
You brought up Ryan Giggs, which is an interesting comparison because a lot of Manchester United fans, given the struggles with coaching over the course of the last 5 seasons, since Ryan Giggs' job, would say, well, why didn't Manchester United do the same thing? My thought on that is that managing Real Madrid and managing Manchester United, and I'll get into this a little later when we talk about the bad, thinking about what my bad is a lot different gig, simply because of the responsibilities that the manager is asked to have.
Right.
The manager at Real Madrid is a coach. They're not involved in the recruitment process as much as you are at Manchester United.
Right.
Zinedine Zidane was bringing players. He was asked to recruit players. He was not asked to sign players. He was not asked to identify players. He was asked the guys that were brought in for him. At Manchester United, traditionally, you have had that responsibility, which was something that Giggs did not have.
Right.
You had the responsibility for overseeing the youth program, the development, the scouting, whereas at Real Madrid, as we can see by Santiago Solari and Zinedine Zidane, their youth program, most notably Real Madrid Castilla, which plays in League Two, is basically run almost as a second organization.
Right.
With players in the system.
Mm-hmm.
So you're being asked to put more of an emphasis on coaching more than the coaching part of managing, more than the managing part of managing.
Mm-hmm.
I think if that situation had been different, it would have made all the sense in the world to bring in a Ryan Giggs.
Right.
But I am left to wonder what would have happened had they actually given him the gig and let him go. Would they be in the same situation, and do they regret that decision now?
Mm-hmm.
Hindsight being 20/20 and all.
Yeah, you got to wonder too, because the Real Madrid model definitely has a more of a general manager type, and it seems very beneficial to a coach who is relatively recently retired from playing and who is really able to learn without the pressures of all the other things that you just mentioned. And, you know, Zidane was, as you said, Zidane was able to come in and just coach the team. And that was proved to be quite positive, and it proved to be a really great experience. Now, we could see Zidane perhaps moved on. A reason that wasn't maybe discussed is that he wants more control over those types of things, which is why he may be looking for a different situation. But it does lend itself to be able to bring in a coach when you're in the situation that Real Madrid was in, and, you know, relatively is still in right now with even with the recent run of wins. That it's got to be a positive thing, though, to have that ability to make that call without the concern that it's going to hamstring other aspects of your club.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
It remains to be seen. It's going to be an interesting one. See
how he takes absolutely.
It. And especially what happens when the hiccups come. There are much tougher matches coming up over after the break. You know, you've still got tougher Champions League matches.
Mm-hmm.
The run is a little easier. They come out of the break with Eibar, but then you got to go to Rome and play Roma and Stadio Olimpico in the Champions League. That's a tough one.
That's a tough
Valencia
game.
Valencia is always tough. CSKA Moscow has proven that they can give people fits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to get tougher as they go on. And certainly when we get to the latter stages and you have another Clásico to see how he handles that. But full credit to him, full credit to the competitive balance in La Liga. It is nice to have another competitive league, especially one in Spain. So
It's nice for us to get some time to really talk about it too, which we should, you know, I'm definitely going to try and do more of to really focus on that, because this is definitely exciting.
So I'm going to turn with my good to another competition that we pay not nearly enough attention to and go down to South America and talk about the Copa Libertadores. The first leg of the finals was on Sunday between two of Argentina's most storied clubs, from Buenos Aires, River Plate, and Boca Juniors, which oddly enough featured two MLS alums as managers. River Plate, managed by Marcelo Gallardo, and Boca Juniors by Columbus Crew legend Guillermo Barrios-Chelada. Down at La Bombonera, which was inundated with rain prior to the game.
That was a monsoon, man. That was crazy.
The game actually had to be rescheduled for Sunday. And it was all the good. It comes out a 2-2 advantage. River Plate going back home. Going in, Boca Juniors were the betting favorite. But despite taking the lead twice, they were unable to come away with the victory. It was a very interesting game. Early on, Boca Juniors didn't look like they knew what to do, because River Plate came out with three at the back, which they weren't prepared for, and they had their star winger Gonzalo Martinez playing in a more of a central role instead of out on the wings, and Boca Juniors was really struggling to handle that. And actually, the thing that I think helped Boca out the most, which was surprising, was when one of their best players, their winger and Argentinian winger, Christian Pavon, goes down. And on Danilo Benedetto for 4-4-2, and they seemed to be able to move the ball quicker and get it in. They scored to take the lead. Unfortunately, River Plate came right back down and scored an equalizer, and the game ended 2-2. So an engrossing final between two heated rivals for the Libertadores championship, the Champions League of South America, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Tournament that we don't pay nearly enough attention to, but we probably should.
Yeah, absolutely. And what is, I think for just what we're talking about with shifting eyes to South America with the football coverage that we like to consume, I don't think you could ask for a better game to get more eyes on this competition. Everyone's aware of the Superclásico, and that rivalry is one of the most heated rivalries in the world of football. I think the only one that can probably top that is one we've discussed already on this podcast, which is the Old Firm of Celtic and Rangers. And second to that is definitely the Boca Juniors River Plate matchup, because I know as we've had conversations about, there are definitely socioeconomic and cultural aspects to this rivalry. And to have them play the final of a competition that encompasses the South American continent in CONMEBOL, I think that's a really good thing. I mean, I'm relatively familiar with teams in Brazil, but the knowledge of the Argentinian game is really not something that we see a lot of in the United States. And then when you look at the Argentinian history in this competition, they've dominated this competition overall. And you look at Independiente with 7 titles, but Boca Juniors got 6. And if you look at it, they have 24 titles by country alone for their clubs in this competition. So this is definitely a way to bring, you know, my eyes, especially on this particular tournament, as because we all know, you know, best players in the world often come out of this continent. And this is a way for us to see. And you also see a lot of these players who start off being loaned to MLS clubs from a lot of these clubs in Argentina. And they're able to get opportunities to play. And often a lot of them will sign and stay in the United States. And so this is another way to grow the game in the United States. And it's another way to really learn about the way the game is different and the same in like basically every corner of the world. So I am going to do my best to try and catch this final. I know they're also stopping for the international break, but I'm going to do my best to catch this final somehow or another, because I think this is going to be really exciting.
Yeah, it shifts to El Monumental on the 24th of November. As you said, Independiente, 7-time champions, their last being in 1984. Boca Juniors, 6-time champions, their last in 2007. Estudiantes, 4-time champions, last won it in 2009. River Plate, 3-time champions, last won it in 2015, and so on and so forth. But yes, Argentina has dominated this. Some big names on the list of former winners, including the likes of Sampaolo and Santos.
Yeah, and Gremio. Gremio's defending champion.
Yes, Palmeiras, memorable for their uniforms, and also the last club of one, Mr. Ronaldinho, Nacional from Colombia, the only Colombian team. They won it in 1989 when they were won Pablo Escobar, and 2 years ago, they came back and won it in 2016.
Yeah, so, I remember seeing some publications on that. That was really, really amazing to see that that club was able to, you know, put Colombian club football back on the map in a way.
Yeah, but that I guess the thing that I've always struggled with was that was a year, as I recall, that they won the Copa Libertadores, but I also feel like in the same season they were competing in the Copa Sudamericana, because that was when they had the plane crash on the way to that game.
Right.
So I never kind of figured out what clubs play in what competitions, but this gives me an opportunity to learn that, and learning something new in soccer is always fun.
Absolutely.
So, that was good for the week. The other good for the week was it was rivalry weekend. I don't know if you caught it, because we had that one, which I wanted to talk about. But we also had, I would say, one of the better Bundesliga games that I've seen recently. Der Klassiker, 3-2 victory for Borussia Dortmund at Signal in Duna Park, or if you want to call it Westfalenstadion.
I like that way better.
In front front of their 80-something odd thousand fans. Mm-hmm. They beat Bayern Munich 3-2, coming back repeatedly. I thought that for a long time Bayern looked like they were just going to put it away, and then somehow Borussia Dortmund just came back, and Thomas Tuchel just took them back into a different direction. It was an absolutely engrossing match, and I loved watching every minute of it.
Yeah, we're getting more Bundesliga on the old telly over here too. So definitely, when I'm not chasing my 3-year-old, I try to have it on in the background, because also I like how the way the schedules worked out. The games aren't always starting at the same time, so it's good to try and catch up with some more of the Bundesliga, because there's no way they can be that dominant international play without having a really strong domestic league. So should get some more eyes on that too.
I do like it, and I did misspeak. It is the manager of Borussia Dortmund is not Thomas Tuchel. He got fired. It's actually Lucien Favre who wanted. Okay. So just want to make that correction for my own personal edification, so that people don't think no idea what I'm talking about. I don't. I don't want you to know that. absolutely pulling all the right strings, getting a late winner. I thought that they looked every bit the undefeated, dominant team that they are currently in the Bundesliga, and a great one there. So before we want to get into our bad, I want to give a big shout out to our sponsors for the evening, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle. Once again, I was down there this weekend taking in the Manchester Derby, which I will talk about in our next segment, and it was an absolute great atmosphere for that particular match, and no place better to watch it than on that 100-inch big projection screen in the back. I want one of those for my house. It feels like you're in the middle of the pitch. And if you had been there on Saturday night, they had the Too Damn Big Band from Virginia come up, which I don't know why it's called the Too Damn Big Band or the Too Damn Big Orchestra, if it just seems the right size to me, but I don't name things. A great concert that was. I'm telling you, instead, if I had a band, I would call it Richard Petty Drove a Pinto.
I bet he was souped up, though, and he had that cowboy hat on. He'd be ready to go.
If not that, then deep flannel. But I digress. It was a great evening, both for sports and live music. So those of you who want to go in early and catch perhaps this Friday's upcoming England-USA friendly, perfect place to do it. If you want to hang out for some live music on Friday, Saturday night, place to do it. If you want to catch the Washington football team, the NFC East leading Washington Redskins on Sunday, perfect place to do it. So I highly advise you to take our advice and go down and see the fine folks at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for sports and live entertainment. All right, so we've done the good, and for every good, there must be an equal and opposite bad. So what was your bad this week?
My bad this week is something that I've just tried to watch and understand, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I know we have a lot of other things to get to, but the ongoing financial fair play saga that has really engulfed two of the newer, quote-unquote, big clubs in Europe of PSG, Paris Saint-Germain, and Manchester City. And it looks like that Der Spiegel, the German publication, has published a WikiLeaks style of Football Leaks article that I read, and I am not going to embarrass myself by trying to summarize it, but it really discusses the uneven management of funds and the uneven presentation of revenue that these two clubs have had. And I can recall when Manchester City, the new ownership of Manchester City, which I believe is from the Emirates. And
Abu Dhabi,
yep. Actually, I have a good buddy from there. And they came in and they started to raid other Premier League clubs. And I know that they came and they took Emmanuel Adebayor from Arsenal very, very quickly, as well as they went and got Robinho. And then they found, I believe they went and got Jerome Boateng. And then you had some other Arsenal players who were itching to get out, and someone that I may touch on later on with Samir Nasri. And this was a club that had one first division championship, I believe, in the middle of the 20th century, had been flirting with relegation often. And then out of nowhere, they become big spenders. And they were given the opportunity to influx some cash into the club. But to see their rise to prominence, anyone who has any sort of knowledge of the way these teams have grown over the years would have to kind of wonder if there's something else brewing in the brewery. And of course, the similar thing occurred with PSG when their new ownership came from Qatar. And these are also government entities with lots of oil money. And then PSG then comes in, where they were a relatively new club that where they played their inaugural season in Ligue 1 in 1970. And I believe they also only had one league title to their credit. And I can recall even being in Paris in the earlier parts of the 21st century and going into shops and going into stores and seeing jerseys for Lyon and Marseille and Bordeaux much more prominently displayed than the local PSG jerseys. Which leads me to believe they didn't have quite the following that a team from the capital and largest city in France would. And then next thing you know, they are also throwing vast amounts of money around buying players. And so when financial fair play came into play in, I want to say, 08, there were definitely – those are the first two clubs that everybody looked at. Like, okay, what are they – clearly they're doing something wrong over there. And they did have their fair share of sanctions from UEFA that probably didn't fit what they were actually doing. But I know there were some threats of – I'm going to let you pick up more on this, but there were some allegations and possible consequences of them losing the ability to play in Champions League. They also had to sell some players to even out their revenue and even out their purchasing power versus their revenue they were bringing in. And then I'm just going to say one more quick thing before I toss this over to you, but the way the financial fair play where each sort of footballing authority in the country has the opportunity to sort of govern it the way they see fit. In England, you had this where over a 3-year period, you couldn't have a loss of more than £105 in your for your revenue versus expenditures. And it was blatantly obvious that City was not going to reach that. And yet they didn't have any significant punishment that kept them from being able to be successful, because as you see, they're continuing to win league titles. And also with Paris, they were able to buy Neymar for 222 million euros. And then, of course, scrambled to sell some players, but it didn't even come close to the amount that they spent on that one player alone. So you have to wonder what else is going on, especially this is occurring at the same time when you had the underlying scandals going on at FIFA that, of course, were brought to light thanks to the American investigation and governing and soccer governing parties. And you're seeing people who were involved in that who have since been banned, such as Infantino and Michel Platini, that to say that things are – that the kids are all right would be a gross overstatement and a real way to sort of keep your head in the sand and not really view what could possibly be going on.
So, yes, their Spiegel articles have been interesting. The 17,000 plus documents that they have collected from WikiLeaks, which go to them. And then they write the articles and publish them. It has certainly been interesting to see what has happened. This is going back, focused mainly on the 13-14 period when Manchester City and Paris Saint-Germain were both facing expulsion from the Champions League for not showing, not complying with financial fair play, which said that you can't basically just throw money. Ostensibly, financial fair play was that you can't spend more than you bring in. It was an effort to prevent teams from having billionaire owners come in.
Right.
And if that owner was to leave, not being sustainable and going out of business. We saw this happen with Portsmouth, where they went out, they bought players. Yes, they won an FA Cup, but then they ended up getting relegated and going into administration.
Right.
Any more would be Gretna in Scotland, who had a millionaire owner who bought them, pumped tons of money in the club, and then mysteriously disappeared, and the club actually went out of business.
Mm-hmm.
So this is trying to keep clubs financially viable. A lot of people say hedge towards the big clubs because Manchester United and Real Madrid, Barcelona turn over so much in international revenue that they have an inherent advantage. In order to do that, Man City and Paris Saint-Germain signed some very, let's call them shaky sponsorship deals.
Correct.
I think 200 plus euro sponsorship for Paris Saint-Germain from the Emirates, who basically own them, from the Qatari owns them, that is just for buying players and promoting Qatar.
Right.
That's all. And FIFA said that the comparable contract would have been valued around $3 million.
Mm-hmm.
103, not the same number to me.
Right.
End of it, though, all that I felt was this uncovered something that I already knew was going on.
I agree.
And, you know, you had Michel Platini and Gianni Infantino apparently flexing their muscle to keep the Qataris happy and going down to the enforcement committee and saying that you can't do this. Now, they were, both teams were eventually, their Champions League rosters were reduced and they were with a hefty fine, but they were kept in that in the competition. And in that competition, that was worth $130 million apiece in prize money. So, all the more reason to stay in it.
Absolutely.
But I'm just left with FIFA and the image of Captain Louis in Casablanca. Sir, I'm shocked to find that there is gambling going on in this establishment. Sir, thank you very much.
Yeah, that's a great pull. Yeah, and to see the amount of money that's been influxed in the billions of euros in the short amount of time is really what has to raise the eyebrow. But you're looking at a couple of other clubs, not quite with the same level of revenue, but there were a few stories that came out a few years ago about, I believe it was Leicester, actually, who their owners are trying to also use their sponsorship deals because, again, when you have the owner who also owns the sponsor who is sponsoring the team, they're able to push more revenue into the club. But they were stopped, and they were basically saying, well, I don't understand. You have blatant evidence of this occurring with other clubs right in front of you, yet you are blocking me from being able to do the same thing to keep my club competitive in the Premier League. And I remember that story, yet I was looking for it recently and I had a difficult time finding it. So I find it a little odd that when other owners who have said, hey, wait a minute, we don't really hear about that too much. And I can't for the life of me think that a club that has been historically a smaller club all of a sudden just takes over really pleases the clubs that have probably had a bit more history and a bit more of a fan base and a bit more support nationally and internationally can just take this sitting down. So this will just be something that keep an eye. I'm sure we might talk about this again down the road, but this was my bad. And, you know, I can't necessarily say this exactly the reasons why it's bad, but of course, when you have reports coming up of this European Super League, which we've been hearing about for a very, very long time, of clubs, you know, different clubs putting in their champions in this sort of Super League that's not really a Champions League format because you wouldn't play in your domestic league, where this one would seem like you're really just going for clubs that have the money, because that 16-team league that has also come out in the leagues has the likes of, I mean, I'm just going to pick on my own club, my own fan club, but they have the likes of Arsenal in there, when Arsenal has not competed well in Europe in a decade. So it's obvious to me, but Arsenal is a club that has a lot of revenue. So this is another, it just seems to me like another way to generate additional monies and trying to get out of the umbrella of UEFA.
Well, that one's an interesting one, and it's funny that you bring up the proposed European Super League.
Mm-hmm.
That is a sort of notion that served every couple of years, and it
mm-hmm.
always happens to coincide with the negotiations in between UEFA and the European Club Association, the
mm-hmm.
ECA, which
yeah.
represents the clubs
right.
for UEFA. And last time it came up was 2016 when they were negotiating.
Right.
And it was the outcome was that UEFA gave the big leagues in Germany, England, Italy, and Spain 4 guaranteed spots in the Champions League group stages.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a pamphlet that sits there, and it's always the nuclear option. If we don't get what we want, this is what we are going to do.
This is what we're
going to
do. Yep.
But that being said, I do believe that it is coming. I do believe that the clubs want it. I think that when you look at everything in it, that the founding clubs, which are the biggest teams in Europe, would have 20-year guaranteed membership without threat of relegation. This speaks to a more U.S.-based model.
Right.
Term stability and franchising, opposed to this, you could be in 1 year, you could be out. And
mm-hmm.
that's what clubs want, is the stability to know that we will be competing in the Champions League. We will be in this every year, because then
mm-hmm.
they can get higher priced sponsorships.
So right.
We talk about the money that the Premier League gets,
mm-hmm.
and has got a new contract, which is in the same general vicinity. But the money that the Premier League gets, that $1 billion a year that they
mm-hmm.
get, it's £1 billion, it's still dwarfed. It's less than 50% of what the NFL annual TV revenue is.
Right.
Now, granted, they split it up 20 ways as opposed to 32.
Right.
But still looking at, on average, 50% more per year going to American football teams then go to the clubs in the Premier League.
Mm-hmm.
They look at the European teams, especially in Germany and Italy, where their television contracts are not nearly as hefty. Look at that with NBC.
Oh, they're minute.
Yeah, why can't we get that money?
Right.
And I think them, they're looking at this as a model. So I don't think that it is something that is set to launch in 2021, as Der Spiegel was reporting. I think it was something that was going to come up because this latest cycle comes up for negotiations in 2019, this coming
mm-hmm.
year,
mm-hmm.
and expire in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I concur completely. I think this is something that we will see probably before we actually think it's going to happen. I definitely foresee this. It's going to come. And the ability for a team in the, you know, the NFL to market and generate revenue at a very high clip, even when the team is extraordinarily unsuccessful, is something that, of course, European clubs are watching. And especially with there's still lots of American owners of these teams in Europe, as well as owners from Thailand and Malaysia and from and of course from the Middle East, that are very well aware of that model. And it'll definitely be a hard sell for the FAs in those domestic leagues and those domestic countries, or domestic countries, but in those particular areas in Europe. But yeah, I can definitely see it coming. But
so
let's go ahead and switch over to your bad, because we could talk about this for days.
My bad is something is rotten in the state of Manchester, and it is not on the blue side. The derby went 3-1 to Manchester City, the first time in the last 6 derbies that the home team won. But what was clear to me in watching that was just the difference in between Manchester City right now and Manchester United. We know that Manchester City are probably the presumptive champions, and they're playing it right now. That makes them look unbeatable, at least domestically. But Manchester United looked every bit the 8th place team. disjointed, not sure what to do, no answers, despite an abundance of talent on the field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is more than a managerial thing. I think, yes, I have questioned Jose Mourinho's managerial style. I question his ability. I can't think of one player on the team that is playing better right now than they were before they arrived or since.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is something that goes way deeper, and I think this is an issue of hierarchy at Manchester United,
mm-hmm.
how they are scouting, how they are managing. It almost seems like they are perpetually stuck in the glory years of the late 90s and the early 2000s, and they have not figured out how to manage in this new football order. They're not bringing along quality young talent. They're not giving them the place to shine. They're not recruiting effectively. And now they have a situation where you are an eighth place team in the Premier League.
Mm-hmm.
Not only you can get wins at Juventus, you can get good wins, but you look like an eighth place team right now. You
right.
look like you'd be competing with the likes of Bournemouth and Wolves, who are exactly who you are competing with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the renaissance of Liverpool and even Arsenal have shown
mm-hmm.
that it doesn't take much to make a change, but you have to make a change someplace in the hierarchy. And my bad is just, it is bad in the red half of Manchester, and something needs changed now. And I don't think it's just Jose Mourinho. I'm laying this squarely at the feet of Ed Woodward and the Glazers as owners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is one of the most storied, decorated clubs in Europe, and
mm-hmm.
they are floundering. It reminds me a lot of Liverpool over the course of the last 7 years when they
mm-hmm.
went through oil after Rafa Benitez left until Jurgen Klopp got there, before John Henry came in with a clear plan and said, I'm going to let football guys be football guys.
Mm-hmm.
Football guy in. You've got the yeah. highest in all of England, and you can't compete. And that
yeah.
says a lot. It tells me that you're just not getting the right people on the field and the right people in management to do the job.
Yeah. Yeah. And the buy-in of the players is really what's really lacking. I mean, I'm still shocked at the really lack of effectiveness a player like Alexis Sanchez has, to the point where he's voicing that he wants to leave and nobody really wants him, especially with his contract. So, yeah, you have to wonder what is it going to take to really turn that club around beyond a real change at the top, because that team has so much talent. They have so much pace. They have so much size. You just look at the sheer magnitude of just how big they are and how well they move. And the fact that they're really just, you're right, they're competing for very close games with Everton, Leicester, Watford, Bournemouth. And don't sleep on Uncle Nuno's club, man. He just drew with Arsenal, and Arsenal could have easily lost that game. So, yeah, it's going to be tough. And you have to wonder, not just are they going to finish eighth place this year, are the players going to start to walk out the door and demand to be sold like you talked about earlier in this season? It looks like that's a very, very real possibility. And unless they do something to really shake up the pot there and really to give the players something to be excited about, I don't really know what they're going to do. Now, of course, a couple of wins over some of the other teams above them, especially the other big six teams, will hopefully reignite it. But, you know, I'm going to equate this, even their wins, I'm going to equate it to what I see on the old NFL side. The team I support is 6-3, and I still don't think they look like a very good football team. And now we're looking at Manchester United, where if they do get a win, you're going, yeah, but I really don't know. They're still sitting at -1 goal differential. They've given up 21 goals this year, and De Gea does not look like De Gea. So, yeah, it's a little scary, especially for any Manchester United supporter.
This is only Fulham has fewer clean sheets in the Premier League right now
yeah.
than Manchester United. They can't
right.
stop people from scoring. and I'm not 100% sure that they know what to do. You have your marquee summer signing in Fred on the bench, even though Paul Pogba's injured. This speaks dysfunction in the ranks.
Right.
So they don't even descend to my length, my life of ugly, because it's not absurd.
Right.
It's predictable. It's just bad. It's just
bad.
But that being said, let's get on to the ugly, because not for nothing, this is where we go into the absurd that is football, and it is one of my favorite parts of the week.
Oh, absolutely. I have two uglies this week. My first ugly is, you know, I for years have picked on Arsenal's physio department and the way players just seem to rack up injuries on that club. And the most recent example is Danny Welbeck. Boy, did you see a picture of that ankle break against Porto in the Europa League? Oh, God. That looked bad. And luckily, it was a clean break. He's only predicted to be out for 3 months. But Arsenal can't seem to keep their players healthy in any real stretch of the imagination. And this year's actually not bad, but you're looking at Danny Welbeck's out. Lichtsteiner's out. Elneny's out. I didn't even realize Elneny was out. Monreal's out. Koscielny's been out for almost 200 days. And these are all first-team players who, and several of these players are starters. So the Arsenal's run recently has been pretty exciting. But, I, you know, that with that injury, I can see the wheels start to fall off a little bit. I think this international break's coming at a perfect time for them, for the players to heal up. But and to just piggyback on that, got another player who was an Arsenal player who thought he was probably, you know, too good to play for Arsenal and ran to Man City, and then got popped for a doping violation, has been out for the last 2 years. But Samir Nasri has been practicing with West Ham United recently and is set for a physical to actually become part of their team again. But they're not so sure about his fitness level, and he may not pass his physical. So, again, keeping players healthy. But I had to chuckle a little bit at Samir Nasri, who was also basically told by the by France, no, thank you. So We'll see what happens there, but I'm keeping my eye on that with just my own entertainment.
I got to go to Senegal with this. Keita Balde Diaw, a forward for Inter Milan, was supposed to go on Senegal. Was supposed to go on international duty with Senegal. Cannot go because apparently Senegal sent the confirmation of the call up to the wrong Inter Milan email address. They used the wrong email address. So because Inter wasn't notified in time, they don't have to release the player. And they're, no, we're going to keep him.
No, of course not.
We don't want him traveling. So the vice president of the Senegal FA admitted that this happened. But to me, this is the epitome. This is the 21st century equivalent of the check is in the mail. I don't know how that happens, but apparently, yes, he cannot go because they used an old email address instead of the current one. Is this one of those things where you send a text message and somebody says, new phone, who dis?
Yeah. Yeah, that definitely what it reeks of. And it's I hate to say this, but these types of situations just seem to happening with FAs in African countries. And the sad thing about this is a country that has a very, you know, respectable international reputation of Senegal. And, you know, I would expect this country's football authority and their football association to have a bit better tabs on these types of things, especially for a player of his caliber. I mean, Keita has played for Barcelona's youth team. Of course, he got sent away for trying to be funny and putting some ice in a teammate's bed. But he's also had a really good stretch of games and a good stretch of seasons at Lazio, playing for Monaco, on loan at Inter. He scored some pretty, pretty impressive and great goals for these clubs. And these are very well-known and very well-supported European clubs. And you would expect that the football authority in Senegal would at least have the right email address.
So as we wrap up things with that ridiculousness, what are you watching for this weekend? I'm assuming the same thing, which would be Friday. England, USA.
Yeah.
Wayne Rooney's international retirement.
Yes. I really think that the English football is doing the right thing. Absolutely. This is the way you show this player respect that I don't think he was given while he was playing for England, month in and month out and year in and year out at international competition. And to have it be against the United States, I think that's even more fitting as he's come over here and he's proving to be a very, very popular player. And he's really done an excellent job in representing himself and also really pulling a club, a historic club in MLS, out of the quicksand that they had been in for years and years and years. And I've spoken about him on numerous occasions on this podcast, and I will be happy to see him captain the squad. He'll start, and he'll probably come out at about the 75th minute to a great ovation from the Wembley support and from the England faithful, and it's what he deserves. But also to see some of these, of course, to see continued development of these young players, and a big shout to the U.S. men's national team for actually getting old Jurgen Klinsmann's son to be a fourth goalkeeper for the squad.
Well, that was an interesting call-up. I mean, Zach Steffen goes out. He is the presumptive number one.
Mm.
But Jonathan Klinsmann, he had been the keeper for the U-20 team during the last U-20 World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
He gets. I am interested to see Wayne Rooney kind of get a fitting send-off into retirement. Mm-hmm. He deserves this sort of testimonial match. I find it fitting that it is against the U.S. This is the perfect opportunity to do it. You know, he's coming off of a sort of renaissance and at D.C. United,
mm-hmm.
and he deserves this. You know, he doesn't fit with what they're trying to do right now. They've got one of the best young teams in Europe, and Gary Southgate has no use for there's no place for him. There's no room for him. They're trying to do right now. I can't think of anybody I'd take out of that team in favor. But it will be nice to see him get the ovation that he deserves and get that send-off.
Yeah. And you look at the England squad, too, that they're bringing on. I mean, Rooney's going to be getting his 120th cap, and you look at the next highest cap is Jordan Henderson with 47. So this is definitely not the squad that England's going to be playing with. And I don't even believe Wayne Rooney's going to be playing for them when they play against Croatia. So yeah,
it's
not in the works. Yeah. But this is definitely nice to see.
Yeah. But that Croatia game is important for their standing in the,
absolutely.
Nations Cup. You know, the victory over Spain set them up well, but they need to pick up that win in Wembley against Croatia early next week. So, my friend, this hour has absolutely flown by.
Absolutely.
It has been great as always. Before we leave, we want to once again thank our sponsor, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, Maryland's premier venue for sports and entertainment. Thank you to you, Stead, for your participation in this brouhaha podcast.
Yes, and thank you to you, Mike, as well. Thank you to you.
Thank you to producer Paul for getting us up and running and dealing with all the technical glitches that we have had to deal with over the last day to get this thing on air. Hopefully we sounded good. I'd like to think we did. It sounded good in my head. But then again, I hear voices and they don't like y'all. one last word as we go out.
Big shout to Zlatan Ibrahimovic winning the 2018 MLS Goal of the Year as well as Newcomer of the Year. Hopefully he'll stick around for a while.
Okay, my last word before we go out is kerfuffle. Why? Because it just sounds funny. Thank you once again.
All right.
And you all have a good night.
Good night, everybody.